To introduce our main speaker, Larry Jay from Dallas, Texas.
Wow. Yeah. Larry Johnson, an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. And you don't know just how glad I am to be here. This has been a great meeting up to right now. I wasn't going to be nervous this time. I say that every time. I'm not going to be nervous this time. I said that to my sponsor one time. He's not going to be nervous this time. He said, then you won't need to talk. We need to keep you sitting down if you don't get nervous. These things, I don't know why I'm not intimidated in the least by this, but it's just, I don't know, I just feel like there's a lot of pressure. You know, and I'm going to do my best to be finished by 8:30 something. I'm going to quit at 10 o'clock whether I'm through or not. It just nobody don't leave. I want to first thing I need to do is thank the people responsible for getting me here. And for my being here today, here in Las Vegas. Thank you for a splendid 10-minute talk. Just absolutely splendid. I love Las Vegas, too. I was saying, why I love Las Vegas? There's a lot of money in Las Vegas. I was saying, you guys have got a lot of money, but there's a lot of money in this town. And I love being around it. I love to go to the casinos and just stand by the cashier's cage. I really do. And just be around all that money. Probably be the most dangerous thing for me to do would be to have some of it. I made a lot of money when I was drinking. I wish I'd have kept some of it. I really did. But and again, thank you for being here. Thank you for having me here. And I'll set out that my task is to share with you, as it's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. And I'll try to do that in a general way. I was born at a very early age and raised in a Christian atmosphere. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came into a group in Dallas, Texas. The old suburban group's no longer in existence now. But it seemed to me like that every meeting I went to for a year or better, that every speaker that got up and introduced himself said, I was born at a very early age and raised in a fine Christian home. And I wasn't convinced that was a place to raise children. It seemed like they were all ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. My situation was a little different, and I say I was raised in a Christian atmosphere, and that's basically what it was. I was born in a cotton mill village in North Carolina. It's a little place called Cordova, North Carolina. I've been privileged to talk in a lot of meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous over the years, and I've only talked in one where somebody actually knew where that was at, outside my sponsor, Tom. And he knows it well. But Cordova's that's all it is, a little cotton mill village. It was a safe place to grow up. There was, in my house, in our house, I guess, drinking... I'm not going to say it was acceptable. My mother never accepted the fact that my dad drank. She was always against that. But my father was a pretty heavy hitter when it came to drinking. My dad was probably an alcoholic. He never came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I talk about my dad a little bit. I lost my father in 97. And the reason I got his permission to talk about him, I asked him one time if it's okay to do that, out of respect for him, and he said it was fine. He loved the idea that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. My whole family loved it when I came to AA, and When I was a couple of years sober, my dad had a 20-year period of not drinking. And for 20 years, it was almost 20 years, 2 months short of 20 years, he never touched a drink. I never wanted to be the kind of drinker my dad was. I always said growing up, I'd never drink like that, and I didn't. I was a lot worse than he was. And I went places that he never went. But a couple of years sober, and my wife Sam and I, we'd bought our first house in 1974. And my dad was visiting, and we were out in my backyard one afternoon, and this is just the way he looked at it. And we were talking about drinking, his drinking, my drinking. And I asked him, I said, "Daddy, you think you're an alcoholic?" And he said, "No." And he'd been sober then since 1957. And I said, "Well, let me ask you a couple of questions, if you don't mind. Do you believe, or do you think that had you not become the person that you became after you stopped drinking?" My dad went from being the town drunk to the most respected man in that community, to the point people solicited him to run for public office. He was the go-to guy for a lot of years. And he was involved in his church. He was, I don't know whatever kind of board they had. He was the head of that board for a number of years. So I said, if you wouldn't do all those things, do you think he could go on this long without a drink? And he says, "No." And I said, "Well, you know, it's a lot like AA. Has some similarities to it. Why do you not think you're an alcoholic?" And he says, "I've never had to go to a meeting." That was just his perception of what an alcoholic was. I took my first drink when I was 15 years old. And I was a social drinker for about 15 or 20 minutes. And I say that, and it's the truth. We did what social drinkers do. There's a bunch of kids in a car. We're going to a ball game. We stop at a drive-in beer joint, and we had a beer. We had a beer. There were six kids in that car. I'm the only one of those six that ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. After I got sober, I checked back on how those guys did. None of those guys ever developed a need to come to AA. But we had a beer. And I don't remember ever wanting a drink like that again. I can't say, you know, I missed out. I hear a lot of people in AA say that their first night drinking, that they got drunk, they went home, they had to put one foot on the floor to keep the room from spinning. I didn't have that on my first night of drinking, but I got it the second. I went back and got more of that, and I drank as much as there was for as long as there was, and that's the only way I knew how to do that. I quit drinking in 1959. I stopped drinking in 1972. It took me 13 years to stop after I quit. Some of you, I know there's some people in the room who remember those old cars that had, the cars used to have, and the old cars had distributor caps on them, and there was something you could set. I'm not a mechanic, but I know that when mine got out of time, the guy would take that off and turn a screw or something in there. And what would happen when it got out of time, and you could pull it up to stop it and shut the engine off, but it would just sit there and run. And that's kind of the way it was. I mean, I quit drinking, but I couldn't stop. I just couldn't stop drinking. I stopped for a while. I was able to not drink for a period of time, and I had a good reason to quit. On July 4th, 1959, a buddy and I were out celebrating our independence. Did a lot of that. almost killed me celebrating my independence. But we were celebrating and drinking all day. And somewhere around midnight that night, we were driving down the old Highway 74 in North Carolina. That's the highway that connects the mountains to the ocean. And we lived kind of right about halfway between the mountains and the ocean. And we're driving down the road. It's about midnight. It's raining. And Earl looks at me and says, "What do you think if we stop at Johnny's and get a cup of coffee?" Johnny's was a truck stop there on the highway. And I says, "Fine with me." And I didn't know we were already there. And he made a left-hand turn off the highway and hit that gravel parking lot. And the car started to sliding, and we ran head-on with a semi. And I used to tell that story because it's dramatic. And I almost had to make up the drama in my life. But in what happened that night, had that semi not been parked at the fuel tanks, you'd have a different speaker tonight. And I guess the point is, in that whole thing is like one of my favorite men in Alcoholics Anonymous that I ever, and I met him when I was 9 months sober, was Norm A. from California. And he talked a lot about seconds and inches. And if you ever listen to his talks, you know that. And that's really what it's like out there. It's really about seconds and inches. Had we been 5 minutes later coming into that place, that guy in that truck would have probably been coming out of there as we were coming in there. We went to the hospital that night. They carried me to the hospital later, sometime over in the morning. A doctor released me from the hospital, and he gave me three little yellow tablets, and he said, "You may have trouble sleeping." And I've always been a real subject to the power of suggestion. I mean, you just suggest it, and I just go do it. I got in a lot of trouble with that stuff. I remember, because mine's running, it's kind of racing right now, but I remember sitting in a bar in Dallas one night, and a guy came into that bar. It was one of my favorite water holes. It was perfectly named. It was called This Is It. This Is It. Then we had another one just a few blocks over called It'll Do. You know, but I was at the This Is It. And he said, "Don't go to the It'll Do." And I said, "Why?" He said, "The Dallas cops are just swarming over there. And just don't go over there." I finished my drink, got in my car, drove straight to the It'll Do, hit a street sign on the way, and he was right. The cops were just everywhere, you know. And I go to jail on another DWI just off the power of suggestion. The guy suggested I not do it, I do it. We leave the hospital that morning. The doc says, "You may have trouble sleeping. Here's three tablets. If you do have trouble, take one of these tablets." I get home and I'm thinking I might have trouble sleeping. Maybe I should take one of these tablets. And they're little bitty things. Now, there's no way that one of those could do anybody any good. I mean, one of anything. What good is one of anything? And then I thought, well, maybe two, but God, they're small, so we'll just take all three of them. But I didn't have any trouble sleeping. That's my drug story. I woke up that afternoon thinking about what had happened the night before, and realized how close we had come to being killed in that car. And I knew, and I just took a quick inventory. And the only reason I was there was because I was drinking. It seemed to me like, in that inventory that afternoon, that every time I got in trouble of any kind, I had been drinking. Now, I'm not going to tell you that every time I drank, I got in trouble. But believe this, every time I got in trouble, I had been drinking. And I had probably the first of a handful of intelligent thoughts that I've ever had. I thought, if drinking causes a person that much trouble, they shouldn't drink. And so I'm having this meeting. All the Larry Johnsons have showed up, and we're having this meeting, and we're talking this deal over, and all of a sudden, I'm agreeing with them. that, you know, I should, if it causes that kind of trouble, then you shouldn't drink. And I made a conscious decision that afternoon to quit drinking. And I felt pretty good. I felt good about that. I mean, I started to coming around a little bit. Did you ever, maybe some of you, you've had some problems, I mean, some difficulty to come along, and you look at your situation, and in an Alcoholics Anonymous, when that happens, I call someone else in. I'm going to get all those Larry Johnsons in there to mess it up. But back then, I didn't, and I never called anybody else in until I got to AA. But you got some difficulties, you think about it, you have a meeting with yourself, and you make a decision to do something about it. It feels pretty good that I've decided to do something about this. And it felt good, and I needed to go tell somebody. And in the next room was my mom and dad. I go in and tell them. And I didn't know anything about being an alcoholic, don't know anything about AA. If I'd heard of AA, I don't remember hearing about it. I know when I got sober in a hospital in Dallas, Texas, somebody asked me if I'd ever been to AA, and I said, they don't have AA where I'm from. And he said, they don't? Where are you from? Where are you from? I said, well, I'm from North Carolina. Well, they have AA in North Carolina, and I said, they do? And I said, not in my hometown. And they said, really? And I said, no, they don't have AA there. When my group elected me the first time as this GSR, I got a directory from World Services. I looked up my hometown. There's six groups there. One of them been there since 1946. But I never heard of that. But I went in and told the folks that I had made a decision to quit drinking. They were delighted. They suggested maybe I go and join the church. I'm always subject to power suggestion. I did what they asked me to do. I went and joined a church. I got up to my armpits and that. And the way I always did everything, I never just went in anything halfway. I just want to get all the way in. And I believe that character trait, it sometimes was a defect and sometimes was an asset. And I think when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I had a willingness to get into Alcoholics Anonymous up to my armpits. And I can tell you, I can stand here and tell you today that after almost 33 and a half years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm still there. I'm just as deep into it, if not deeper, today than I've ever been in my life. And I believe that's why I'm still here. I believe it's why I'm still sober. And I believe it's why I'm still alive and why I have the life that I enjoy today. I was able to not drink for 3 years, and one afternoon I made the almost fatal mistake that a lot of alcoholics make. I was riding around one day, inventorying my life, and almost breaking my arm, patting myself on the back about how good I was doing. I had met a girl, named Betty Lou, and Betty Lou and I were a cute couple. Now I got to tell you, she was a pretty thing, and I thought I was, and back in those days, I don't know if you can get a picture of this or not, but I had kind of an Elvis Presley hairdo. You imagine that, and probably, I don't know what I was thinking, but I bought me an old white Ford car, and had them spinner hubcaps. I was just so cool, and I had that pretty girl named Betty Lou, and I remember I tucked those spinner hubcaps in, and they had those little square things in them, and I took some fingernail polish and painted every other square red. They were just really pretty stuff. You know, just anything to draw attention to me, you know. And then on the doors of the car, you know, this is 1959 or 60, or like 1959, late 1959. And on the doors of the car, on her side, there was Betty Lou. You know, I wrote her name on the car. And then I wrote my name on the other side. So there's Larry and Betty Lou. And we got married. I don't have any way. We got married in April of 1960. I don't have any way of proving this, but I'm almost sure that the Secretary of War signed the marriage certificate. We'd gotten along beautifully. And then we got married. And we were two people who could not live in the same house. They're just people who shouldn't try to live together. And we were those two people. After I got sober, I did an inventory on that. I tried to figure out what it was that went wrong there. And I finally figured it out. She didn't like me. And I didn't care much for her. And in a way, two people with that kind of attitude could stay together. Now, we didn't fight all the time. We have two beautiful children. And you can't make children when you're fighting. I guess you could. I don't know how you do that. But the night that I met Betty, I remember sitting on her grandpa's front porch with her. He had an old porch swing out there. Well, kind of a country western music fan. I don't know if y'all ever heard that old song about Charlotte John, just a swinging. Well, we just were swinging on that porch swing, and I thought it was a date, but a lot of guys think that when the first time you go out with a girl, and I'm not an expert on relationships, I'd be the last person in the world you'd want to talk to about that. But that's interview night. She asked me 100 questions that night. And so you get interviewed. And one of her questions was, and I'll move on, I'm going to get out of there and move ahead here pretty quick. But one of her questions she asked me, she said, "Do you drink?" And I said, "No, I don't. I quit." And she said, "Good." And from that day to this day, that's always been my answer. I figured it out. Well, this keen alcoholic mind, we figure this stuff out. I was interviewing, Betty and I separated right after Christmas 1964. My son Darrell was 3 years old. My daughter Kimberly was a couple of months old when we separated. And I went to Greensboro, North Carolina. And I was interviewing for a job. And the guy had asked me lots of questions, and it was in the retail furniture business, a business that I had some experience in and some knowledge about. And I answered all his questions timely and correctly, and I knew that. I knew I'd give him all the right answers. And at the end of the interview, he pushed back from his desk, and he said, "Larry, I got no more questions to ask you." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Do you drink?" And I said, "No." And at that time, I was in my second phase of not drinking. I had made that mistake after 3 years of patting myself on the back, and I didn't tell you that, but I ended up in a bar that afternoon. But now this time I had another period of not drinking, which lasted a year and a half. And it was during that period, and he said, "Do you drink?" And I said, "No." And a lot of people had asked me that, and my answer is always the same. And that afternoon, I asked him, I said, "Why did you ask me that?" Because I never asked, "Why did you ask me that?" I thought I kind of knew. Because anybody asking you that question, they have a reason for asking that. They've had a problem with somebody. Well, they wouldn't be asking you that. I said, "Why did you ask me that?" And he said, "The man that you will replace in our company is an alcoholic. And we're not hiring any more of those." And I said, "Well, I don't blame you." I wouldn't hire one of them either. Why would I hire an alcoholic? And I couldn't leave well enough alone. You know, I had to expound on that with him. But anyhow, he gave me a job and hired me into management in his company. And just a few months later, during that next few months, Betty had got a lawyer filed for divorce, and all that was in the works. And my life was an absolute train wreck, just a train wreck. But I wasn't drinking. But my life was a shambles. And one afternoon, this guy that gave me this job because I was not an alcoholic, gave me this job because I didn't drink, called me back Saturday afternoon. He said, when we close this afternoon, come by the office, and JD and Will have gone to the liquor store to get a bottle, and we're going to have a little drink. Come by and have a drink with us." And I said, "Well, you know, I don't drink." And he said, "Yeah, I know." About 5:30, I stopped by the office, said we're going to close early and have a drink. Well, I said, well, maybe you didn't hear me, so I said, you know, I don't drink. He said, son, I know you don't drink. We're just going to have a drink. And I said, oh, okay. Yeah. So 5:30, I show up, and this is kind of what it looked like. There's a pint of vodka. There's some cups and some ice and some juice and four guys sitting at a desk about to have a drink. And I can assure you this, I'm the only guy at that desk that afternoon that did the math on that pint. Guys, I immediately did the math on it. And it wasn't hard. I mean, 16 ounces in a pint, we all know that. And there's it's 4 ounces a piece if everybody gets a fresh cut of that deal, you know. And so we finish off that bottle of vodka. And here's basically in a nutshell what happened. We close the deal down. Ed gets in his car and he went home to his family. I didn't follow Ed home, I know that's where he went because it's where he always went. And JD and Will got in their car and they went home to their family. Didn't follow them either, but I can guarantee you that's where they went because that's where they always went. And I headed for California. Because that's what I do when I drink. And me and a buddy loaded everything we had, and our neighbors had gone to the beach or somewhere for the weekend, and we took some of their stuff. Back in those days, people didn't lock their houses, but guys like me, are the reason people lock their houses when they leave town. Anyhow, we're going to California. I can't wait to get there. I just can't wait to get to California. I mean, the guy said, would you like to go to California? And I said, man, I'd love to go to California. I've always wanted to go to California. Well, I'd never really thought about it. Lee brought it up. But we needed to go somewhere. And I didn't like that rotten town I was in to start with. We just needed to go somewhere. So we headed out to California. And I lived in a fantasy world anyhow. My whole life was just one big fantasy. And we're riding down the interstate somewhere, but probably between Atlanta and Birmingham or somewhere across there. And I'm in my mind, I'm already there. I'm walking the beaches of California. And I could just see it. I'd let my hair grow long and grown a beard and got me some of those cool glasses and some open-toed shoes and cut my britches off and cut the sleeves out of them. You know, I'm just out there, man. Out there with the rest of them trying to find myself. Because that's what, this is the mid-1960s where everybody, we're trying to find ourselves. I mean, nobody gone anywhere, but we're just busy looking for ourselves. And we made it all the way to Fort Worth. For those of you who aren't up to snuff on geography, that's Texas. And that's the end of the California trip. It ended right there in Fort Worth, Texas. Never made it to California. We got bogged down there in Fort Worth. Stayed in Fort Worth a while. Fort Worth used to be a bad place to live. So I moved to Dallas. And in the middle of January of 1966, I met this gal sitting over here, my wife, Sam. She and I went out on our first date, and we think it was the 15th of January. She'd be more apt to remember that than I would. That's the date we use, is the day that we had our first date. I'd started calling her about a week before, and she says when she gives her Al-Anon talk, we immediately started lying to each other. And we didn't stop that till we got in the program. Sam and I went together. It got to be hard to call that a courtship. We were married the 27th of May of 1967. I had gotten into car business in Texas, and I'm the kind of guy, and maybe there may be some guys like that and gals like that as well in this room. But when I went to work for the man, I worked 10 times harder than the guy next to me because I thought I had to. I was always the first guy there and the last guy to leave, and I worked hard while I was there because I thought I had to. And I had a lot to cover up, and I could cover it up with work. And now I've left this family in North Carolina, and I'm living two lives, and one of them's a lie. and some days both of them are. And I'm drinking more and more, and the booze just kind of has now become a way of life for me. But through that hard work, it paid off. It paid off financially. It paid off in promotions. I was 28 years old, and I was a general manager of one of the larger automobile agencies in Dallas. And a year later, I was looking for a job. But Sam and I say we were married. I'll tell you a little bit about our wedding day. We were at a big wedding in Dallas a few years ago when it dawned on me what our wedding day was like. I never really thought much about it. But it was a big reception, and it was a big affair. And we get invited to places today and have for many, many years. We get invited to places that we never dreamed would get invited to. You know, having been in Alcoholics Anonymous and the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me and my family, we have been able to go places that I never dreamed that I could go, or places that I would dream about going and wonder what it would be like to go there. And I've been to most all of those places in Alcoholics Anonymous. But we were at this big reception and the kids were there. I go to meetings just like if you come to this meeting. I go to meetings with young people. Somebody said, why don't you go to meetings with all those young guys? I said, because I can't find you. You know, I can't find guys like you. And that's just sad, isn't it? But I tell you the reason I'm still an Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the reasons that I need to stay here, and the reason that, and I'm not going to share it with you rather than ask you, but one of the reasons I believe you need to stay here is we need to be here to tell the new guy and the new gal about Alcoholics Anonymous when they come in our door. We need to be here to tell them about AA, just like someone was there to tell us about Alcoholics Anonymous. A man I sponsor has just taken on his the only guy that he sponsored. He just got a new guy to work with. What a relief that is to a sponsor. Man, I mean, he's got him somebody to work with now. I don't have to, and he's, it just makes a lot of difference. I just was so glad to see that. But he asked me yesterday, I talked to him on his call-in yesterday, and he said, What should I do with this guy? So he said, should I just put him right in the book? And I said, why would you do that? I said, well, don't shove a book in his gut right away. I said, why don't you go visit the guy and sit down with him and tell him about Alcoholics Anonymous. Introduce him to where he's at. And get him acquainted with you and you with him. And then maybe on your second or third visit, you get in the book. That's what they did for me. The men that brought me to Alcoholics, the one man in particular, the night that he sat and talked with me, he told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me what I needed to do if I wanted to stay sober. So now, getting back to this deal. At this wedding reception, these kids are all talking about their weddings, and one of them looked at me and said, Larry, you want to tell us about your wedding day? And my wife, Sam, just cringes. She don't want to hear about that. I said, yeah, I'll tell you. I said, it was the 27th of May, 1967, 7 o'clock is a Saturday morning. Sam came down, got me out of jail. And on the way home, I looked at her and I said, you know what we ought to do? And she said, yeah, we ought to get married to stop all this foolishness. I don't think that's what I was going to say. But I lost my train of thought when she said that. I think probably what I was going to say is we ought to stop by the liquor store on the way home. I mean, I've had a hard day. I've been in jail all night, man. I mean, I need a drink. But she said, I said, well, you know, that's probably not a bad idea. So we call some friends, we get in the car, we drive to Durant, Oklahoma, and we get married by a used car salesman, and we've been married ever since. Now, the used car salesman was licensed and qualified to do that wedding, but that was our wedding day, and it was a wonderful, beautiful occasion, I'm sure. I don't remember much of it. I carried her, well, the first thing, we go to a jewelry store where she had some credit, so we get some rings. She wanted rings, but it'd been okay with me if we hadn't had rings. I didn't care. And she used to tell that we bought the rings on her credit, and I've since made amends to her for that. And if you go by and look at her hands, and you'll see some of the amends that I've made over the years, and not on credit. But anyhow, we were married 6 months. And I laid out all night for the first time. What I want to share with you now is what alcoholism began, the look that it began to take in our house. Because alcoholism has a look about it. It's easily recognizable, in particular in the home. Now Bob and I were talking this afternoon, and he kind of reminded me of an old talk from one of the old Father Martin talks about how you could go in a sober environment and pick out alcoholics who weren't even drinking. You just pick out the people surrounded by them. I hope you didn't. I'm not stealing this stuff, but the people around them will let you know by their behavior and how they carefully handle themselves around the alcoholic. And but it began to take on a look at our house. And I'd left work that Saturday afternoon. I was general manager of this place, and I shut it down and went down to have a couple of drinks with a couple of my salespeople. And I laid out all night. That was the first time I did that. And I came staggering home about 8:30 or so on a Sunday morning, and I walked in to our home, and we lived in a little apartment there in Dallas. And I knew when I opened that door that she would be standing on the other side, and I had all my answers ready. I had it scripted on what I was going to tell her. But when I opened the door, she wasn't there. And I walked on inside, and I walked in, I found her, and she was lying on the bed. And I looked in the bedroom, and there she was, lying on the bed, fully clothed, shoes and all. And in my mind, she was in bed. But she wasn't in bed. I learned the difference that morning between being on a bed and in a bed. There's a difference, and it just never dawned on me till that morning. And I looked at her, and she looked at me, and I saw a look from her that I hadn't seen from her. I'd seen it in the eyes and faces of others around me, but I'd not seen it from her. That look of disgust and hurt, pity, and maybe even some self-pity. I don't know. It's a recognizable look. When we look into the faces of the people who love and care about us, when we're in that alcoholic behavior. And I looked at her. She looked at me. She never said a word, and neither did I. And I left the room, and in a bit I came back, and I was ready to join her in bed. Because in my mind, she was in bed. I walked back in the room, and the look hadn't changed. She didn't say anything, and neither did I. And I went over my side of the bed. I turned the covers down, and I got in the bed. And when I got in the bed, she got off the bed. And when she got off the bed, she pulled the drawer of her night table open and extracted from that drawer a .38 pistol. She clapped. You don't go to Al-Anon, do you? But she took that pistol out of that drawer, and it just the whole dynamics of that morning changed right there, I guarantee you. This is, and I'm watching her now with much anticipation. And then I thought, don't panic, that gun's not loaded. And she knew it wasn't loaded either. And she reached back in the drawer and took out two bullets. And she pushed that lever. She looked like Annie Oakley. She pushed that lever, the wheel fell open, she inserted the two bullets, closed it back up, pulled the hammer back, lined one up with the firing pin, and I heard it click. And my next thought was, somebody needs to create some dialogue. Well, we got to talk. It's quiet in there. And I was saying, and I had a question that I wanted to ask, and I didn't know how long I had to ask it, but I wanted to get it answered. And I don't know if I raised my hand. I probably did, like a second grader, you know. I mean, she's in full control of the situation now. And I said, honey, you know, geez, can I ask you a question? She said, yeah. And I said, why did you just put two bullets in that gun? She said, that's easy. She said, Larry, I can't live like this. And we're not going to live this way. We're just not. I can't do this. I can't do it like this. And the answer to your question is that one of the bullets is for you and the other one is for me. And I started to really talking. And I did some pretty fast talking that morning. And we got that gun put away. That's what alcoholism looks like. That's what it looks like. Alcoholism kills people that don't even drink. A few years ago, she heard me tell that story, the first time she ever heard me share that story. On the way home from the meeting that night, she said, I need to talk to you about something. I said, what's that? She said, about your talk tonight. And I thought, there's something wrong with it. And it probably was. She didn't bring that part up. But she said, no, it has to do with that incident with that gun that Sunday morning. And I said, well, what about that? And she said, well, I remember that incident almost exactly the way you do. And of course, now she's got a little time in Al-Anon. And after a while, they know just when to, you know, take their shots. And she said, and by the way, that's about the only thing that you shared that I remembered the way you do. But I mean, it's like Clancy said, it's all perception. Isn't it? I mean, it's just how you perceive it. She said, but I need to tell you something, and I've been wanting to tell you for a long time, and I've never really known how to say this, what I'm about to say to you. And I said, well, what is it? And she says, well, I want to tell you the truth about that Sunday morning. And I said, well, what is the truth? And she said, Larry, the truth is that I never intended to use my bullet. So it's called ego deflation at depth, huh? There's more than one way to achieve that. It was 5 years later, and I had run out of airspeed and altitude all at the same time. I'd found my place that Sunday night. I'd found myself in a place to where my life was no longer acceptable to me. And that's bottom. That's bottom for me, when my life was no longer acceptable to me. And I sat in the middle of the floor. I had been home for a couple of hours. And I'd been drunk for about 3 weeks. I don't know how many times I'd been in jail at 3 weeks. There's no way of knowing. It doesn't really matter. But I remember I was sitting in the middle of the floor. And I'd been begging her for money. I had begged her to go get me something to drink. And I don't ever want to forget that night. I don't ever want to forget the pain, the physical pain of needing a drink, of knowing that that's the only thing that'll stop the insanity. It was the only answer I knew. And I begged with her and tearfully pleaded with her to go get me something to drink. And she dug her heels in and refused to go. And then something snapped inside my head, just like it did in yours. I knew that moment in time that my life was no longer acceptable to me. and that I could no longer live the way I was living. I must have known at that moment a little bit how she felt 5 years before that Sunday morning, that I can't live like this anymore. And I said to her, I said, I can't live this way any longer. Would you please find me some help? I can't do this anymore. And somewhere deep down inside of me, I knew that my life was over the way I had been living it. I don't know how we know that, but we know that. I think that God put something down inside of each one of his kids. And there ain't enough booze or anything else out there to mar that. He somehow, in his infinite wisdom and grace, keeps that from being damaged. And some call it a conscious. And I like to think that that's my knower. And down in my knower, I knew that my life was over the way I had been living it. And I was willing at that moment in time to do whatever I had to do to stop this insanity. And she said, Larry, who do you want me to call? And I don't know who to call. I don't think about calling Alcoholics Anonymous. Never came to mind. They tried to net me 2 years before in a state hospital. AA did. And I ran out from under the net pretty fast. I didn't ever want to get caught in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you why I didn't want to go to AA. It's a pretty simple deal. There's no mystery to that. I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because that's where alcoholics went. And Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. And I was not an alcoholic. And I didn't know that night whether being an alcoholic never really came up in the conversation. But I asked for help. She said, who do you want me to call? And I don't know who to call. The TV was on. Seemed like the TV's always on at a drunk's house. I don't know why that is. We went to dinner over at Rich's tonight. The TV was on. What do you mean sound on it? It was just on. It's like that. It may still be on at our house, and we left there yesterday. I don't know. But the TV was on, and on the TV screen was a commercial for a place in Dallas, Texas, that you could take a guy like me and get him some help for what was really wrong with him. There's a place called the Center Hospital. It said the Center Hospital for the Treatment of Alcoholism. And down at the bottom, it said, if you've got a problem with alcohol, call this number. And I looked at her and I said, call those people. And she went to the phone and called. And it was 11 o'clock on Sunday night. And they just made the shift change the nurses had. And she got a little nurse on the phone. And somehow or another, I mean, about 4 minutes I'm out of here. But somehow or other, that little nurse who was not an alcoholic had been given the gift that I believe that God gives every one of us if we're just receptive to it. I believe it's necessary in Alcoholics Anonymous to acquire this gift or receive this gift. And that was a gift of being able to sense the desperation in the voice on the other end of the phone. And she was able to sense that. And she said, honey, hang that phone up and somebody will call you right back. And this little nurse called the guy that ran that place, got him out of bed on Sunday night, and probably said, I wasn't there, but I like to think that Chris said something like this. Tony, I just got a call from a lady, and she sounds desperate. I think this family is desperate, and they need help, and they need it now. They don't need it in the morning. Because he called her, and they talked, and they arranged for me to go see him. And when she hung the phone up, we had made the arrangements, and she hung the phone up, and she put her coat on, and she started out the door, and I said, where are you going? She said, I'm going to get you something to drink. And I said, why? She said, because he said to. And I'm thinking, I don't know this guy, but I like the way he thinks. But he knew. He knew what to do. Thank God he knew what to do. He knew that if she could get something to drink in me, she could get me to bed. and get me to him. What happened in the phone call? What happens in the phone call? We, you know, she makes a call. She takes me to him. He brings me to you. Man, that's what happened. He brought me to you. He put me in his treatment center, kept me there for 28 days. He didn't paint any rosy pictures. He told me before I left there, he said, if you don't end up in Alcoholics Anonymous, you ain't got a cut dog chance of making this deal. Just like that. Tough guy. And I left that place after 28 days, and I found myself in an AA meeting that Monday night, and I've been going ever since. And all I've had to do in Alcoholics Anonymous was to change my whole life. I'd hear the whispers, just don't drink and go to meetings. If you want to stay sober on self-knowledge and willpower, I guess that's the way to do it. But that ain't the way they laid it out to me. They laid it out, and there was a lot of work to do. And since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, it would take a whole other meeting, and maybe I should have spent this meeting on that. I don't know. My life has changed. Those two children in North Carolina I had to make amends to them. I did not want to do that. I didn't want to do that. I could not do that. By the time I got to that, I was 2 years sober, and I'd been gone for 9 years. And to make that amends, I had to let her know where I was at. Because I'd been on the lam. I'd been living that lie. And now I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't live a lie any longer. And I knew that if I contacted her and let her know where I was at, that she had the right, and rightly so, could have me put in jail. But I had to be willing to risk that. But not until after I spent a lot of time with a sponsor and a lot of times on my knees and a lot of time talking to my wife and daughter. And I remember saying to Sam that I'm ready to do this when you're ready. If you're ready to give me up, you may have to give me up for a while. And when you're ready to do that, let me know and I'll make the call. And I wrote Betty a letter. Sam said, you do whatever you have to do. And I wrote her a letter. And after 4 days, I mailed that letter on a Thursday. And on a Monday afternoon, Betty called. It was the first conversation she and I had in 9 years. And she said, we got your letter today and we wanted to call. And she was willing to forgive. Just like when I wrote that letter, and I don't know if there's anybody in here that needs to make an amends like that or not, but there's a page in our book, and I don't know what's on every page in that book, but on page 79 are the directions for that amends. It's specific directions for that amends. And I opened that book that day, and I wrote the letter based on what it said on that page and through sponsored direction. As a result of that, as a result of God's grace and goodness and the power of that step and the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, those children were put back in my life, and they're still there today. And I have three children. I have two girls and my son. I don't have a lot of time to tell you about my kids, but I can tell you that they're all living productive lives. Productive, respectable lives today. And our life today is beyond belief for us. It's a long way from that mill house in Cordova, North Carolina, to where I am today. It's a long way from there. You can't get to here from there except through God's grace and power and a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for having me.